Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. Today we're taking on the controversial topic of immigration. Controversial both in the culture at large and among the objectives community. So I've invited Ankar Gatte. Ankar, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. So I invited Ankar Gatte to join me today to talk about this. Ankar is a senior fellow and our chief content officer at the Ayn Rand Institute. And we're going to talk, we're going to devote pretty much the whole show to this question of immigration and try to cover it from all the different angles that are both addressed out there in the culture and addressed within the discussions among objectivists, among libertarians, among classical liberals. This is obviously a huge and controversial issue, and hopefully we can bring some clarity to some of the topics, issues involved when discussing immigration. So thank you all for listening. You can call in on the topic of immigration today. Please, no calls on other topics. So let's stick to the issue of immigration. 347-324-3075. So if you have any specific questions or if you want to make a comment, you're welcome to do so. 347-324-3075. So let's start, Ankar. Let me start with just a kind of a meta question. Why do you think this is such a big issue, both in the culture, obviously with in the presidential campaign, and I'd say both in the Democratic and the Republican side? We can talk about Bernie Sanders' views on immigration as well. And also within the objectives community, why is this such a big issue, so controversial, so heated?
Well, within the objectivist community, I think it's partly because there's a view that the country and more broadly Western culture is going downhill, and there's an attempt to somehow stop that. And I view that we're going to stop it through immigration policy as a really, at best, a false hope that this can do anything to stop cultural decline. Indeed, I think we're both, I think, on the view that borders should be open and you should be letting in any peaceful person who wants to work or wants to live here. I actually think that immigration controls and advocating for these kinds of things will hasten the decline, not prevent it. But I think that if there's an argument to be made, it's that they're trying to prevent the decline.
Yep. Yeah. And so let's start kind of from the beginning in terms of how to think about these issues. And let's start with a world of laissez-faire capitalism. Let's assume a world in which we've achieved all our goals. We have a rights-protecting government whose sole responsibility is the protection of individual rights. What does a border in such a context mean, and you know, how does one think about immigration in that context?
I mean, I think that you should weigh in on this, but I think that the concept of a nation is important, and the concept of borders are important. I mean, a proper government, so we're talking in a free society, has a monopoly on the use of force in a geographical location, and that geographical location has to be specified. It has to be clear that this is the extent to which its power extends, And within this geographical area, what it's doing is putting the use of force under objective control, which means objective laws which define when force can be used in retaliation against those who initiate it, and when someone's rights are being violated and the institution of government has to step in. And so the concept of a citizen is important as well, that it's the citizens who delegate their right to self-defense to the government, and it has to be clear who's doing that. And then the whole, I mean, there's obviously foreign policy ramifications to all of this, that outside your borders is, that's the area for foreign policy that has to think about that. But also just, like, how to view non-citizens when they're in your country, and how they're, what it means to say that they're subject to the laws, nevertheless, and how to view citizens of your country, and again, of a free country, who are dealing with, say, economic, they're doing business in, I don't know, some third world country in Africa. How does the government view that? What happens if that African country, say, nationalizes all the property, or you could take some South American country that, course of the last few decades, does that regularly. What's the government's attitude toward that? And you have to know in advance that, the government's not going to view this as an act of war against you and so on. So you're taking an enormous risk if you're doing business in those countries. And all this has to be clearly defined, and you have to know how that works. So the concept of a nation and of borders and of citizenship are all important concepts for the objectivity of government, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And indeed, there hasn't been a lot of work within objectivism on defining and categorizing and identifying exactly what that looks like, what the difference between a citizen and a non-citizen would be, and how to deal with foreign engagement and what a border, you know, in that sense, when somebody comes in, what is its status as a non-citizen and yet as a person now being protected, whose rights are being protected by the government, and what the status of that. I mean, there's a lot of work in objectivism that needs still to be done to clarify all that and to work it through. And it's not self-evident, and it's not simple, I don't think. But let's move to the issue of immigration, because I think we both agree that there's importance to having a border to clarify a lot of these issues and who you're protecting and who you're not protecting. But also in terms of foreign policy, that is, there is an issue of there's a border and under people invade you across that border. And clearly part of the job of the government is to protect you against invasion or against the entering of people who are committed to doing harm to yourself. So this brings up the question of, on that border, you know, should there be screening? I mean, should there be a way for the government to tell who's entering and who is not?
I think, I mean, you should weigh in on this because you have thought a lot about the foreign policy kinds of issues. I think there could be, from the perspective of particular countries, if they know there's organized groups trying to attack us. So certainly many of the Islamic countries, which have various groups, often state-sponsored, so they're really extensions of the state, who are trying to kill us. So there has to, it's certainly proper to have that kind of investigation. I think some investigation, if there's reasons to think that criminals are coming in, so I think there can be a variety of issues. It's not clear to me that means everyone has to be screened. And on the issue of, there's also the issue of infectious disease and so on. I don't view that as a distinction between citizen and non-citizen or immigrant and a citizen. If you're worried about infectious disease, I mean, an American can carry infectious disease just as easily as any other person.
I mean, they used to be something at the borders where they would try to monitor. They would have people monitoring people coming off the planes, for example, when there was bird flu, and to see whether you had a fever or not. And if you looked like you had a fever, they didn't really care if you were a citizen or not a citizen. They would take you aside and they would screen you. They would test you and make sure that you weren't sick and quarantine you if necessary. So I think that's right. I think it doesn't really matter in terms of diseases, you want to screen at the border when there's a risk of such diseases, and it's pretty rare, and it's pretty known when such risks exist. And with regard to the foreign policy, I think context is everything. I think it's why you would probably have different levels of screening depending on where the person came from, and because certain countries are at war with the United States, or because certain groups are at war with the United States, it's completely appropriate to ask somebody to show a document to show them where they're coming from, because this is exactly that responsibility to protect us against invasion, or to protect us against people committed to violence against us. It's exactly that kind of screening that needs to be done. And asking somebody where they're from does not violate their right in any sense. And if they're from a place, or you know, it's like profiling. Or I'm for profiling at airports and places like that. I don't consider that a violation of rights if there is a known threat from a particular ethnic group, Muslims, or particular religion, and you happen to look like a religion, and you're on private property, an airport, screening is necessary because you look that way. That's not a violation of your rights to demand that, and I think border posts are the same thing.
We're talking again in the context of a free society, so we're talking in the context of a coherent foreign policy. So
yes, threats would be a lot smaller in that context.
And you can't have, to take one example, that we view Saudi Arabia as a great ally, but what we want to do is screen the people because we worry that they're all terrorists.
Nuts, and that's the context of today's foreign policy. So you would have clear definition of who the enemy was, and therefore you would have clear criteria to screen them based on that. So there's some question about in kind of the discussions about among objectivists about this issue is of whether somebody has a right to cross a border. That is, whether let's assume freedom, or at least in the United States freedom, whether somebody from outside the border, a Mexican, a Canadian, has a right to cross the border. How does the issue of rights apply to people's ability to travel, to move from one country to another?
I think you need to think about, or one needs to think about it from the perspective of both of the people involved. So I definitely think there's a right to emigrate. That is, to leave a country. If you think it is going downhill, it's going to politically collapse, or just you think some other country is way better, even if you think you're going to maintain a sort of mediocre political environment. So that you have a right to emigrate. That is, the government does not have any right to prevent you from leaving, as say in the whole communist bloc and the wall. So that's from the person exiting a country. And then in entering, it is, why is someone entering and on what terms? And I look at it much more from the perspective of the people in the country who want to deal with. If I travel to Colombia and I meet someone who we get along really well, we want to start a business here back in the U.S., the idea that I need my neighbor's permission in order to do that, I think, is a violation of my rights.
But does that mean that the person coming into the country has to show that they've been invited in a sense, has to show that they've got a job or that somebody is willing to host them?
No, I view it the other way around, that the government has to have some reason to think that, oh, this guy might be part of a mafia in Colombia, or he might be part of a terrorist network, something like that. That you have to have some reason to think that he's taking actions that are a violation of the laws and the rights of your country and your citizens.
Yeah, so the burden here has to be on the government. And I want to go back to, I mean, as I view it, in a free country, you would have, I mean, we'd have clear borders. I think a wall would be ridiculous, but you would have clear places in which people would be expected to enter that country, partially because there are issues of property rights. In a free country, the land, the land that is adjacent to the border would be owned by individual private people, and it would be engaged in trespassing if you just crossed randomly at any given point. There would have to be specific checkpoints, which would then allow government to do some kind of screening, and that the same at the airports and at the ports and places where people enter into the country, there would be some process of screening, or at least give the option of screening. That is, if there was reason to screen, I think it, for the most part they just let people cross. But if there was reason, they would stop and commit some kind of screening.
Yeah,
some people have claimed that the screening itself is a rights violation. That is, that the government needs a strong, in a sense, it's preemptive, or it's like preemptive regulation. It's assuming you're a criminal in advance.
I think there has to be some reasons, and part of what law would define is what those reasons have to be. And again, this is relevant. The citizen, non-citizen is relevant. That some reason doesn't have to mean the same thing that would warrant searching a citizen, because you do a traffic violation or something like that. It doesn't have to be that it's exactly the same in terms of thinking of a non-citizen wanting to come in and work or live in the country. So, but there would still have to be some positive evidence and positive reasons, and that would have to be defined into law. But if you think of just our current context, the way that now when we go through airport security, everyone is screened. You're a naturalized citizen now, but you were an immigrant. I don't know what your experiences were like crossing the border when you were a non-citizen. I'm still a non-citizen. And I know what it's like. It's awful, and the idea that I might be carrying drugs, worse, that I'm coming here to work and take American jobs, and that everyone's screened like that, I do think is a violation of rights.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Once you become a citizen, the shift in attitude at the border is quite stunning. Suddenly the Border Patrol people are saying, welcome home, and they're smiling and they're friendly. But when you're not a citizen, even if you have a green card, you get questions and they really screen you in a very, very different and often antagonistic way.
My experience with government, interactions with government, the Border Patrol is by far the worst. It's like you're committing a crime because you want to come into the country, and they have so much arbitrary power. We've been taken away, where they're going to do a search, and you can't do anything. You can't call a lawyer. You basically can't even talk back.
Yep.
I find it very scary.
Although I have to say, you're from Canada, I have to say that the Canadian border people are even worse. Traveling into Canada, even as an American with an American passport, I mean, the drilling they give you, what are you doing here? Why are you coming? What do you want? And I think they have a certain hostility towards Americans kind of embedded into it, in addition to it.
Remember when we sent, this was quite a while ago, the talk in Canada, and they stopped some of our materials from the Ayn Rand Institute.
Yeah, that's because they had the hate speech laws in Canada, which luckily we in America don't have. So they banned a box. They confiscated a box that we shipped there because it said something like on the top, it said a moral defense of Israel, and they thought that would have hate speech in it, and they confiscated it, and it made a lot of news in Canada. So it was quite a big deal.
We'll talk about the issue of ideology and screening, but that kind of example is relevant to thinking about it.
Yeah, and that's the next topic I actually wanted to talk about. So let's the big issue, I think, that seems to animate objectivists and some libertarians is this issue of ideology. And we'll talk about it. I want to talk about it in two contexts, although they're very much related. One context is kind of laissez-faire capitalism. So America is the in some sense, the ideal country. And the worry is you're going to have all these people coming in who have not accepted these ideas that relate to laissez-faire capitalism, the ideas that underlie the limited government and the government as a rights protector, and they're going to bring their statism and their collectivism with them into the country, and soon enough the country is going to deteriorate into a mixed economy, or much much worse than that, and some actually go back and argue that this is the cause of America's decline, is in a sense its open immigration policies in the 19th century, because statists from Europe came in, and as a consequence of that, the principles of the founding fathers eroded, and that's why we live in the world we live in today. So to combat that, the solution is ideological screening in this ideal world where we actually know what the right ideas are, so that in theory we could do the screening. We can get to what happens in a mixed economy where the people who are doing the screening are even worse than the people coming in. But in this idealized scenario where we actually know what to screen for, what is your view on this notion of screening for ideology, screening for ideas?
I think absolutely not. The idea of giving the government power to police political and ideological ideas, I view that as the beginning. I mean, to put it mildly, the beginning of the end. It's really just the end.
Yep.
And you can read a little bit about Ayn Rand's view of this in Political Crimes, political in quotes, crimes, which is in Return of the Primitive, or if you have the older, the New Left. I can read a little bit about what she says. But there's similar things in Dr. Peikoff's Subjectivism, the philosophy of Ayn Rand, in presenting her philosophy is. Just to read a little bit of what Ayn Rand writes. Since an individual has the right to hold and to propagate any ideas he chooses, in brackets, obviously including political ideas, the government may not infringe his right. It may neither penalize nor reward him for his ideas. It may not take any judicial cognizance, whatever, of his ideology. Also interesting, if you want to get Ayn Rand's perspective on this, is her notes to herself about when she testified to the House of Un-American Activities Committee. And this was the investigation of the communists, but of the Communist Party, of a party dedicated to the overthrow of the U.S. government. And she makes, it's very interesting reading, and the distinction she makes between investigating someone because they hold an ideology versus being a member of a party. It's like being a member of a terrorist cell that its intent is to overthrow the government or to assassinate citizens and so on. Those are very different things.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would be the same as during the Cold War of not letting people who are members of the Communist Party in East Europe or in the Soviet Union come into the country, just like we wouldn't let terrorists or people who advocate or members in some group associated with Islamic totalitarianism come into the country today. So what do you think is at the root of this idea of ideological screening? It strikes me that part of what the advocates, the objectivist advocates of this are doing is they're really reconstructing the purpose of government. I mean, they're taking government from its only purpose, really, the protection of individual rights, to somehow the preservation of a set of ideas, of a set of philosophy that, granted, is at the root of the protection of rights, but now is a much, much broader mandate and a very dangerous mandate. I think you're right. This is the beginning of the end of any kind of freedom in a proper society. But there's a certain sense of collectivism in here that we have it right and they don't, and we're going to screen them out because they don't have this right set of ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, the conversation about Hispanics do X, they vote in this way, or they have these beliefs, and Asians do Y, and Blacks do Z, and this kind of, this focus on groups and reasoning through groups and using statistics, from that, I find it very collectivistic to look at things like this. And you could equally well spin an argument. You could do it in regard to the welfare state, too, when we come to talk about that. But for that, Americans have made such a mess of their country and of what Jefferson and Madison and the other founding fathers have done, that the only hope from an ideological perspective is immigrants who appreciate what America was about, like, for instance, Ayn Rand, who will try to restore the ideology that the Americans have turned their back. If you're going to put it in those kinds of collectivist group terms, I could spin an argument like that. I don't think that's true either. But it's just not the right way to look at the world, I think.
Yeah, and this, you know, the ideological screening, once you start doing that at the border, what in principle would prevent you from doing it internally? If you come to the conclusion that in order to sustain liberty, people have to have, the objectivist epistemology and metaphysics and political ideas, then how do you stop an argument for public education or mandated curriculum in schools? What about schools that teach communism or teach religion or teach? How would you prevent private education in the United States from teaching by what argument could you not prevent them from teaching bad ideas?
Yeah, and I agree with that completely. And the issue of public education, I think, is really important because that is one of the things that has undermined the American experiment. And the best justification of it is exactly this kind of thing, that, look, our founding of the country and of America is based on a set of ideas and a philosophical perspective and including cultural norms and values, and cannot survive in the absence of that. So we need government institutions that are going to promulgate those ideas and those values and that kind of culture. And how else to do it but for the new and next generations for them to learn? So we need public schools and civics and so on so that they learn these things. And this is from the objectivist perspective, I think is completely wrong. And I think, I brought up you can find this in OPAR, Objectivism and Philosophy of Ayn Rand by Dr. Peacock. Let me just read a little bit from that. It's on page 367. A proper government is based on a definite philosophy, but it can play no role in promoting that philosophy. Such a responsibility belongs to private citizens who can keep the right system only by exercising, in quotes, eternal, and Dr. Peacock puts in brackets, ideological vigilance. If the agency with a monopoly on coercion undertakes to enforce ideas, any ideas, whether true or false, it thereby reverses its function. It becomes the enemy, not the protector of the free mind, and thus loses its moral basis for existing. Close quote.
Yeah, that's perfect. And it's that was Thomas Jefferson's. What you mentioned was Thomas Jefferson's reasoning for having the University of Virginia and starting the whole process of public education in America, which is probably one of the greatest tragedies the founding fathers. First, the biggest tragedy is slavery, of course, but second to that might be the sanction of public education, particularly Thomas Jefferson's. But I think Leonard also brings out an important point there about the vigilance of individuals. And the fact is that, and I think what people ignore is, if people with bad ideas come into the country, you don't have to deal with them. You know, sanction them. Don't employ them. Don't you as an individual have every ability to make them unwelcome. I mean, if you think that's appropriate, if their ideas are so harsh and negative that you would find them offensive, don't employ them, don't deal with them, don't befriend them, don't and make them unwelcome. And that's really, you know, the way in which one deals with people who haven't yet violated rights but hold really bad ideas, it's to you know, discriminate against them, which is legal in a free society.
Yeah, and the positive, which is advocate for the right ideas and for what the original American conception of government and of individual rights actually means. And the ideas that, again, bringing it sort of into the today's context, the idea that that is what is animating the anti-immigration crowd, that they have a real, genuine, positive conception of what America is about and what individual rights are about, and so, and they're trying to protect that against these people who have an ideology that undermines it. I don't think that is at all true. When you read what the Republicans' reasons are, for instance, to take that side of the anti-immigration cohort,
I agree with you. Yeah, no, they're really, really bad. And I would say there's another sense in which this whole argument is so defeatist and so, I don't know, it denies free will, particularly in a free, in a truly free society. I think this is also true of a mixed economy, but certainly in a free society, the idea that we will achieve this amazing system of government better than the founding of the country, you know, a really consistent, objectivist political system, and that would somehow be threatened by people coming in, by immigrants, that we wouldn't have the self-esteem or the ability to convince and persuade that the immigrants are so evil and dumb and stupid that they would not be convincible of within a generation or two, that we would somehow succumb to their ideas, that they wouldn't succumb to our ideas, given that our ideas are so much more superior to theirs. It strikes me as taking such a position of weakness relative to the rest of the world. I mean, I would take 10 immigrants to every citizen in a completely free society and feel completely confident that we would not lose freedom as a consequence of their coming into the country. Quite the contrary, we would be converting them and at least their children to the cause of liberty.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree that the ideas is not a number game. And you also can't stop ideas at a border, even if you're stopping people. I mean, Kant did not emigrate from Germany and into America, but his ideas came, and they didn't only come because there were some people moving from Europe to America. So it's the whole framework, I think, is very anti-ideas.
Just to take a common issue. Yeah, as long as the ideas are right. I take a common issue. I mean, it's the inequality stuff came from Europe and has become a big issue in America, not because of immigrants, but because of books, because of intellectuals, because of ideas. That's the essence of all of it.
Yeah. I mean, on that issue, Ayn Rand predicted what would happen with the egalitarian cause and how it would spread. And it's spreading through the American universities, not the immigrants in the infiltrated American universities or something like that. So at best, it's a red herring to focus on immigrants and this kind of, I mean, I think there's other bad reasons for why people focus it, but it is a scapegoat. And this often happens when you think you're in decline and so on. You're looking anywhere and everywhere if you could find someone who you can blame it on. And if we only got rid of these people, we would be better off. And to me, that is part of the mentality that moves you towards dictatorship. And Ayn Rand wrote about this Big Business, America's Persecuted Minority, about how dictatorships require scapegoats, and whether it's the bourgeoisie or whether it's the Jews in Nazi Germany. And immigrants, I think, are becoming a scapegoat. Because you asked...
Yeah, definitely on the Republican side. I think that's right.
Yeah, and I find it very scary.
Yep, I know. I agree. I cringe during the debates whenever they start talking about immigration. I find that so offensive and so disturbing. So two other things I want to do before we get to the case of the mixed economy. One is, and we talked about this in the past, I do think that, again, with regard to borders, when there is mass migration, and how you define mass migration is one of the things the government would have to do properly. But, I think we've talked about a case. Let's say there's a civil war in Mexico, and people are just flooding onto the border, and you know, hundreds of thousands are going to cross. The fact is that it is the role of government, that border. It's the equivalent of an invasion. It is a foreign policy issue. There has to be some regulation of what happens on that border. There is private property at stake. There are the individual rights of Americans, and the violence that is happening, let's say, in Mexico, whatever it is, could easily be, come across the border into the U.S. So there is a role for government in those situations of stopping that mass migration. I mean, this will apply to our discussion in a little bit about Europe, but even in this, in an ideal laissez-faire country, this would still apply. It's not like anybody under any circumstances, whatever, just crosses the border at any time.
Yeah, and I'm even open to the argument that, because some people bring up the kind of question of, well, what about a little country like Sweden or New Zealand? What happens if all of a sudden 80 million people decide they want to emigrate from their countries and immigrate into this? Do they have to just accept everyone? And I think there is an issue. Again, it's from the perspective of the objectivity of government and of its functioning, not on the issue of screening for ideology or something like that, that a government can say, look, we don't have the resources to now carry out the laws to police. I mean, there has to be some ratio of police to the rest of the citizenry. So that it is, like, we can't take 50 million, 80 million people overnight. I could see an argument for some sort of total numeric quota for small countries and things. I mean, it's hard to imagine it applying it to the U.S., but I'm open to that. But it's, again, from the perspective of the objectivity of government's functioning, not from a central planning mentality that we want these people but not those people. I'm opposed to all that in regard to immigration.
Yeah, and that is such a science fiction type scenario, or it is so unlikely to happen, particularly at a small country like, where do the 80 people come from? How do they get there? Who pays the bills for their travel? Independent of some real crisis overseas like what's happening in Europe right now, it's hard to imagine how that scenario would happen. Okay, one other issue that I hear this a lot. It comes up in immigration, but it comes up in other debates as well. And I find it a little silly, but it is. I think it does bring up some issues. And that is using Gulch as some kind of model for an ideal society or ideal country. And I get this from the anarchists to say, look, in Gulch, there's anarchy. There's no police. There's no military. There's no government. And then I also saw it among those opposed to immigration, kind of the flip side. John Galt would kick out anybody he didn't like and would prevent people from coming into the valley if they didn't like him. They wouldn't let them in. So what do you think about this whole idea of using Galt as a model for how government would function, how a state would function?
I think it's completely wrong, and I think Ayn Rand, if you read, she viewed it as wrong. If you read some of the questions she got on this in the Ayn Rand Answers, the Best of Her Q&A, which is edited by Robert Mayhew, you can see her. I think she gets the question from the point of view of how can you be opposed to anarchy, because in Gulch do it with anarchy. And so, and it's not a society, it's not a country, it's not a nation. Doesn't have a government. It's a private retreat that Midas Mulligan starts, and then other people purchase land from himself. You have in a private place, you can say, no, I don't want these people. I don't want to sell land to you. I don't want you to come in. We're not going to rent our rooms to you, and so on. But it is not a political model. I think it's obvious in the book that it's not. It is a retreat and an escape for some individuals in the context of a country collapsing into dictatorship. It is not the model for what a country or a nation looks like.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And it drives me crazy when people try to take also literary phenomena or literary characters and turn them into literal meanings, a literary technique, and turn it into the actual reality, dropping all context. Okay, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna talk about immigration in a mixed economy. So immigration today, we'll talk about illegal immigrants, we'll talk about Europe, we'll talk about all the different arguments against immigration that are brought up today, and discuss what we think should be a proper immigration policy in the world we live in now.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism, and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at aynrand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at aynrand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller, or go to Amazon.com.
All right, we're back. We're talking about immigration. I've got Ankar Gatte, a senior fellow and chief content officer at the Ayn Rand Institute, on the line with me, and we're discussing the topic of immigration. We talked about it, immigration under laissez-faire capitalism, and now we're going to shift to, I guess, the more controversial issue of immigration in a mixed economy, or immigration in the world we live in today. Ankar, go ahead.
Yeah, before you turn to that, you might want to say, you often talk about the difference between immigration and citizenship, and that saying that people can immigrate and that U.S. citizens can deal with foreigners and so on is not the same as that they should be granted citizenship. I think that's a point you should talk about before we turn to the mixed economy.
Yeah, although I think it's an important point no matter what system, and I think it becomes even more important in a mixed economy, but because citizens in a mixed economy has so many more has so much more power over what happens in the world than it does in a free society, because in a mixed economy means democratic society, which a true free society is not. But yeah, I think that citizenship should be hard. Coming to the country should be easy. Immigrating to the country should be easy. Citizenship should be hard. I think citizenship should require spending significant time in the country. So it's an opportunity to actually, in a free country, certainly absorb the culture, the important, significant, positive cultural elements that are part of a good culture. It is an opportunity to learn the ideas that make a free country free. After all, most immigrants who come to America, even today, are coming because America's freer than the alternative. So they, at some level, in some way, whether they know it explicitly or not, and I think most of them know it explicitly at some level, they're coming because they want more freedom. So, you know, giving them an opportunity over a few years to live in a free country and to really appreciate what freedom means before they become a citizen is valuable. And because a citizen requires a different approach from government, that is, government has more obligations in the sense of protecting rights towards the citizens. For example, foreign dealings. You know, the reason we have embassies and consulates overseas is because they're there to, in a sense, represent citizens who are traveling. But if you're not a citizen, you don't get access to those embassies. You don't really, your government is not protecting you, or the government of the country you're living in does not have a responsibility to protect you. So all kinds of ways in which the government has more obligations towards a citizen than a non-citizen. So I think we can create significantly more requirements with regard to citizenship. And there I don't think you can have an ideological screen in the sense of you have to believe these ideas. I think you can have and should have a knowledge screen. That is, you should, and we do today in America, although it's pathetic today. You know, you can memorize five questions and it answers to five questions and they let you in. I think there should be to be a citizen, you should really understand the American system of government. You should be tested on it. You should understand the principles on which it's based, at least at a level of a kind of a, and maybe you should be required to take some kind of class on, you know, American government and what it means and how it functions and so on. So it should be a challenge. It should be an achievement to become a citizen. And it should take time and it should take knowledge to become a citizen. And I think that's part of how you screen out the people who would vote, you know, to eliminate the system. Although, again, I think that's very difficult in a truly free country. It would be very difficult to do. It's ideas, and you would have to convince a lot of ideas, a lot of people to go against the ideas that at the foundation of freedom in order to do that. And I think anybody believes that really, again, as we mentioned earlier, has a low self-esteem in a sense, doesn't really believe that we can defend ourselves, which I find ridiculous. So I think the difference between citizenship and immigration is important and substantial and should be made very clear in the law and should be very clear to the people emigrating in. And the details of how you treat citizens and non-citizens definitely, I mean, are complex. And I think that's part of what a legislature in a free country would be engaged in defining. Did you want to add anything, Anko?
No, I think it's good to say that.
Yeah, no, I think it's important, and I think it's important both for a free country and for a mixed economy. And I know people think that in a mixed economy, we couldn't get that. That is, today, nobody would let us have non-citizens who live here for a long time without becoming citizens. I mean, I think that's as likely to happen as any other proposal about immigration that's out there that has been argued about and fought about. And at least an argument about making it difficult to be a citizen is one that we can feel comfortable about doing on the basis of correct principles, rather than arguing against immigration and therefore having to argue against the protection of rights in order to argue for some greater protection of rights in some other realm of and this trade-off of freedoms, which is a very, very dangerous territory. So that's actually what I want to talk about first. Yeah, I want to talk about this issue of how we approached in a mixed economy. Put aside immigration for a minute. How do we approach in a mixed economy, kind of what laws we should support and what laws we shouldn't, and the whole issue of how we move from a mixed economy to a truly free economy, and the kind of trade-offs that engage and how to deal with those kind of trade-offs.
I mean, I think you have to seriously think of whether any proposal is moving you in the direction of freedom. And in that context, when you're talking about a mixed economy, I mean, what Ayn Rand's advice to politicians was decontrol. You have to think of what any particular proposal is. Is it actually decontrolling or adding more controls? And part of, I think, how to think, I have as a general rule or as a principle, the more advanced the mixed economy, the more it's moving towards complete statism, the less willing I am, this is a very strong less willing, to hand government any power. So in regard to immigration, the idea now that it's an advanced mixed economy, so we're going to give the government all kinds of power and they can put up walls at the border and so on, I think is a complete disaster. The context is a mixed economy. So the context is that the government in various kinds of ways is operating on the wrong premises, on the wrong principles, will have attracted corrupt people into the government. And the idea of giving them more power, and to put it in more individual terms, the idea of when I cross the border and I get grilled about, are you coming here to work and take jobs away from Americans? So the idea of giving that person more power in the name of freedom, I think, is perverse.
Yeah, and I think this applies to something where, you know, this principle, you know, another issue that there's some controversy about. But for example, the NSA. I mean, the idea that in a world we live in today, in spite of the risks of foreigners, in spite of the terrorist risks and everything, but given how they abuse our rights left and right, and how they are taking on police powers in so many different ways, the idea that we would allow the NSA just to listen to everybody and think, oh, but they're only going to go after terrorists, is so naive and ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because of this mixed economy, or to arm police to the teeth, you know, to give police military style weapons, which, you know, you could make an argument that the gangs have big weapons, so they need big weapons. You can make a individual rights argument, but in the context of a government that's abusing our rights to the extent that they are, to give them those kind of weapons, I would be flat out against it.
Yeah, and on the issue of the militarization of the police, it's partly the mentality of the military is, and rightly so, is to kill the people who are an enemy. The citizens on which a police is working among are not the enemy, and it's a very wrong perspective. And part of what the militarization of it is, it's certainly the weapons, and they have armored cars and tanks and so on, but it's also the mentality of looking at people in the way a soldier has to and has to be trained to. Same with the NSA. I mean, that's a good example to think about. The issue is not, I have nothing to hide, so I don't care if people listen to my conversations. That's not the issue.
Yeah, no, I agree. And somebody on the chat is asking, military equipment does not mean military mentality. And I disagree. It absolutely does. As somebody who's had military equipment and it changes how you just being, having a big gun at your disposal. I mean, a big gun, a military style gun, changes, it has an impact on your psychology. It really does. Even when you've got the best intentions in the world, it makes a big difference.
You could talk a little bit about your experience in Israel as part of the military.
Yeah, I mean, when I was in a tank in the Israeli army, you know, there's a certain bloodlust that comes with it. It's scary. And I had to really, really think about what I was doing and really, really, you know, control it. And I'm a pretty, you know, pacifist person as an individual in terms of use of violence. I hate violence. And yet, once you give somebody even an M16, and you start running around and shooting it off, it gives you a sense of power that is, I find, very dangerous. And if it gives me a sense of that kind of power, wow, to hand it over to just police and given where the police typically come from and given the rules of it, kind of the attitude that government has today, to give them those kind of tools scares me. Also, the same person asked this question, how does shutting down immigration give more control to government?
I mean, it's how you would shut it down. The idea of these borders that are militarized and creating, I don't know how long, how long the border with Mexico has to be. You'd have to do, have you ever crossed the Canadian border? You'd have to do, and that's the longest peaceful border in the world. The idea of setting up walls and so on, it's massive government power, and it's
a massive budget. It's a massive budget. I think the border control today in the United States spends more money than all federal law enforcement agencies combined. It's just unbelievably expensive even today when they don't do that much.
If you really think we're moving into dictatorship, to have walls. Okay, they first might be used to keep the so-called undesirables out. They're going to be used to keep people from leaving or from leaving with your property. You think the U.S. is bad and so on. Okay, you can go, but we're taking all your assets. Giving government that kind of power over the border that it can make these kinds of decisions, I find that if you really think we're moving into dictatorship, it's a double reason not to do it.
Yeah, and we've already got some laws like that. We've got laws, for example, if you give up your U.S. citizenship, there's a special tax. There's a way in which they tax your income in a way that is very, very prohibitive and meant to discourage you from leaving, in a sense. That's exactly
right.
What they're trying to do. Okay, so let's get into some of these issues. So the big issue is in a mixed economy is culture. So Mexicans have a very different culture than we do. They're going to kind of come in here and they're going to destroy our culture and therefore speed our descent into authoritarianism, speed our descent into greater statism. How would you address that?
I mean, we've talked about it in some ways in regard to ideological issues. I don't think you can fight ideological issues by physical force. This is in the context of if one really thought this in regard to immigration. And it's worth knowing that this kind of argument has been made throughout American history, that immigrants are going to corrupt the country and corrupt the culture and corrupt our norms and corrupt our values.
Been made in every single immigrant group from the founding of America, every single one, and the name calling and the attitudes. It's, you could switch out Hispanic for the Irish, the Jews, the Poles, the Russians, the Germans, all of them, every single group.
And I think the evidence is it doesn't happen. It's worth thinking, too, that in regard to immigration, there's a selection bias. And this is, again, different than if there's a civil war in Mexico and people are just fleeing. the people who are coming to the U.S. are in large part coming because it has more freedom than the countries in which they're living. It has more opportunity. They want to move up in the world. They want to make something of their own lives. And the idea that it's certainly not every immigrant thinks that, but there is a selection bias towards that. And the idea that that is corrupting of American values and of what the American nation is about, I think it's the opposite.
Yeah, no, I agree. We're both immigrants, but and Ayn Rand was an immigrant, but even just my gardener. I mean, my gardener, I'm sure is an immigrant. He's possibly an illegal immigrant, and you know, he works hard. He does a great job. A handshake with him. He's here to make a living. He's here to have a better life. He's here to improve his own life. Now, you know, some people in the chat are saying, yeah, but they come here, but what they really want once they get here are the same policies that they ran away from. They want free daycare and free lunch and free lunch programs in schools and public education. But the funny thing is that in Mexico, there is no free daycare. There's no free lunch program at schools. Kids don't go to schools often. I mean, the idea, we actually have a worse welfare system in a sense of welfare than many of these poor countries do. We have more socialized medicine in the United States than they do in China. This notion that now they might want those things, but it's not because they had them in Mexico that they want them.
Yeah,
and Americans want them too. What Americans don't want that? And who's the real problem?
I never think in terms of immigrants and non-immigrants. The classification of people based on what passport they hold or what country they happen to have been born in, it doesn't tell you anything about the person, other than he had the misfortune of being born in Ethiopia or into poverty in Vietnam or something like that. But
I view it in the reverse. If you're an American and you were born in America and you've benefited from living in this country and you are advocating for policies that are going to destroy it, I view that as a lot worse than some immigrant who doesn't know any better coming into this country. So my gripe is with Americans. It's not with immigrants.
Yeah. And there are economists who study that. Now, it's hard to study the issue of assimilation and to think what variables, but I haven't finished it, but there's a new book edited by Benjamin Powell and it's published by Oxford on the immigration issue and some of the data and economists surveying. But these are people who know how to use statistics, how to control for variables and so on. And there is not, if anything, they find a positive, Powell has a new article, which I haven't read yet, about a positive impact on institutions from immigration. So institutions from the perspective of sort of these indices of economic freedom and looking across countries and what does immigration, what is the impact on sort of these economic institutions. And there's other things about assimilation. And the analysis I've seen, there's no difference. There's no essential difference in assimilation by Hispanics or Asians versus, you brought up the Polish and the Italians and so on, in earlier generations.
I've seen the same studies. I don't think there is any difference. The one difference would be that if you, as a political party, vilify a particular group, if you make them out to be the scourge of the earth and you emphasize that and you don't stop talking about it, you're going to alienate them. You're going to alienate individuals who belong to those groups, and then there's no way they're going to vote for you. And in my view, that is exactly what Republicans have been doing over the last, certainly over the last, since Ronald Reagan, you know, just vilifying Hispanics. And surprise, surprise, I think many of those individuals are saying, these people are spewing hatred against me. Why would I vote for them?
And I think that there's a lot to say on this, the issue of focusing on the voting And this idea that, well, voting for Democrat is you're voting to violate rights, and if you vote for Republicans, you're not voting to violate rights. I don't agree with that at all. Why is this focus on Hispanics and their voting? You can find there's all kinds. If you're going to have this kind of group focus, there's all kinds of groups who lean heavily Democrats, Jews.
Yep.
Lean heavily Democrat. Blacks lean heavily Democrat. Women lean heavily Democrat. Is it so? Do you look at with I can't stand women because they said they're violating my rights? Is this how one should think about it? I don't think of it like that at all. And it's interesting to look at the. I mean, you brought the trend in regard to the Hispanic vote and to look at that. It's interesting to look at a lot of the trends. I was looking at a Pew, and we could talk about it, a Pew Research study that goes from 92 to 2014 and some trends of people who identify as Republican-leaning Republican and Democrat-leaning Democrat. And the trends are interesting. And I was reading of a historian who looks at in California, because you often make the point, which is true, that you can look at how Hispanics lean and so on. It's also relevant with what the that they don't vote much. It's very low turnout. I was reading an article by a historian in California where he's talking. There's a definite, when California started vilifying these immigrants and day workers coming into California, and we're going to send them back and we're going to shut this down, so which started in the 90s, the voter turnout for what they classify as Hispanic starts increasing significantly. If you have a whole group who's animated and vilifying you and sending you so-called sending you home and all this, I would turn out and vote more. So the interpretation of the voting statistics, even if one thought they're relevant, is there's a lot that has to go into that interpretation, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and. I think people abuse these statistics. I mean, I see it all the time, and unfortunately, people are quoting heavily from Ann Coulter's book on immigration, which I mean, I don't know how anybody could take anything Ann Coulter says seriously. She's really a political hack and a demagogue. But describing California, Southern California, as this horrific place to live because it's becoming more and more majority Hispanic. And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, if you, including the very Hispanic areas in Southern California, this it is so xenophobic, borderline racist, the way these things are being described, and Mexicans would do this and Mexicans would do that. I mean, it's complete garbage and complete nonsense. I often, some of my favorite restaurants are right in the middle of Santa Ana, and you walk around there, and yeah, it looks like you could be in Mexico, but it's completely safe, and it's everybody speaks English, and it's a nice place. It's actually really nicely developed and friendly and American, in the good sense. Yeah, everybody around you is Mexican. So what? It's just amazing to me that comes across as those kind of statistics are taken seriously. They're not really, as you said, some people know how to do regressions and know how to control for things, and other people can just throw numbers together and find causality where there is none.
But if you look at some of the other trends of they're interesting, such as that. So if you want to, if this idea of screening ideologically at the border, postgraduates, so have some level of postgraduate education, lean heavily Democrat, and it has from 92 to 2014 increased significantly.
That's right.
Women has increased. Now, and if you think of some of what the Republicans advocate, I mean, how anti-science they are. Yes, someone who postgraduated, a lot of them are in the sciences and so on. I can't have anything to do with a person who doesn't, and a party that doesn't believe in evolution. That they lean Republican might be decreasing. It's in significant. or at least there's reason to think that it's in significant part because of what the Republican Party has become and what they have embraced. The only positive trends in this Pew thing for the Republicans are the white Protestants and the evangelicals. Yeah, because the party's moved so much in that direction, and it alienates everyone else. And I think rightly these people are alienated.
And this includes young people. I mean, young people used to vote 50-50. It used to be 50%. I mean, every other cohort of young people in the past has been basically 50-50 between Democrats and Republicans. And over the last 8 or so years, it's gone 70-30. And this is, I think, a direct consequence of kind of the social policies that the Republicans advocate and how that alienates young people.
I mean, I also think there's a bad in the way that socialism is more respectable. Sure. It's part of what they also learn in the schools. But it's, again, they're learning it not from immigrants. They're learning it from Americans. So there's this kind of argument that, well, it's not ideological because voting is an act. You can't penalize or criminalize how a person votes. If you want to banish a party, like if it was the Communist Party, and you say this is dedicated to the overthrow of the government, and if you're banning the party, that is one. But I can't take seriously that one is banning the Democratic Party. And I actually don't think of it as certainly Obama is bad, but that it's obvious or even true that the Democrats they're going to violate rights left and right, and the Republicans, well, they are somehow rights respecting. I mean, every Republican candidate in these debates goes out of his way to tell you how he's going to destroy the Constitution by totally obliterating the separation of church and state. And he's going to implement all these kinds of laws to restrict the board or ban it completely, which is a massive violation of rights. So if you take it because part of what the Democrat, I mean, a significant part of what the Democrats advocate is in fact a violation of individual rights, a significant part of what the Republicans advocate is a violation of individual rights. And if that act is against the law, you can't vote.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Although I think I view the Democrats as in some sense worse than you do, just because as the whole political map has shifted and Democrats have become even more leftists, I think they become more nihilists than they were 10 years ago. I mean, Bill Clinton, I long for the days of Bill Clinton.
I agree with that. But it's much more the way it's being looked at. It's people who vote.
Yeah.
As we've talked about, I mean, Silicon Valley leans heavily Democrat. Do I think these are nihilists? No, I think these are among the best people in America. And there's reasons for why, good and bad, for why they vote Democrat. And even though I agree with you completely, the Democratic Party is worse. And I mean, this slew of candidates, my God. But it's the idea that if you're voting Republican, you're not voting for the for massive violation of rights, I think, so that you would look at a voter and say, well, if you vote Republican, oh, you're a good person, and if you vote Democrat, oh, you must be real a nihilist or something like that.
I want to quickly comment on this notion, and I've seen this written, that the Democrats have this agenda of opening up the borders so that millions of people will come into the country, vote Democratic and institutionalize, you know, them into power forever. Because what's interesting here is that Bernie Sanders, who represents this left-wing conspiracy, you know, side of the Democratic Party, is very anti-immigration. Now, you won't get it from his plaque, where he's very careful because there's certain interest groups. But in an interview with Ezra Klein, who is like a centrist Democrat, who is kind of very pro-immigration, says something about, wouldn't it be great if we could sharply raise the level of immigrants that we would permit or even have open borders? And Bernie Sanders goes, open borders? No, that's a Koch brothers proposal. And Ezra Klein, this is a video interview, is clearly shaken up. And he's like, really? And Bernie Sanders going, no, that's a right-wing conspiracy against labor unions to lower wages in the country and all this stuff. Sanders is vehemently anti-immigration. Again, he won't say it explicitly. And by the way, unions are anti-immigration. If you go back to Bush's proposals about opening up immigration a little bit, I mean, they were pretty moderate. It was the unions and the Democrats who killed the proposals because they don't want immigrants, because they have a very Marxist view of economics and of labor. And indeed, most leftist economists want walls on the borders because they believe immigrants reduce standard of living and reduce wages. So the left is not pro-immigration. You know, they're not as violent and as vehement as the right is, but basically there's unanimity across the political spectrum about closing borders in one way or the other.
I read Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, his immigration handbook for the new Republican majority, which is the January 2015 document. And this could be written by a Democrat. It's so on the side of, I mean, it portrays it as, I'm on the side of the American worker, but it's on the side of the unions and a massive protectionism. And the idea that that they're pro-business, it vilifies employers, who it treats employers as a special interest. And big corporations, and he singles out Zuckerberg and Gates and the Silicon Valley and the high-tech industry because they want more lax immigration policy so they can hire the people they want to hire and bring them into the U.S. and into Silicon Valley. And it's such a personal vilification of these people. And that's the kind of the idea that the Democrats are anti-business and the Republicans are pro-business. I wish that were true.
Oh, so do I. I mean, everything you said could have been taken right out of Bernie Sanders. I mean, that's his big complaint about immigration. Immigration is a corporate American conspiracy against the workers of America and all this stuff. I mean, the left and the right in this country, unfortunately, tragically, they're all left. From economics, when it comes to economics and rights violation, it's just disgusting. We don't have a lot of time, so I want to talk quickly about this issue. I mean, there are a lot of issues still we could talk about, but let's quickly say something about illegal immigrants, and then I want to talk about what's going on. Let's talk about illegal immigrants and see how much time we have left over.
Okay.
What's your view of this whole idea of illegal immigrants?
Well, first, I don't think one should use these euphemisms that some of the people who are on the side of lack of more open borders, laxer controls on keeping people out, undocumented workers or things like that. They are illegal in the sense that there's laws on the books which say you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z, and they don't do it. Does one then say that, well, you've broken a law, you're an SOB, and so on? And I think of it very much like there's all kinds of laws that people violate. Take speeding limits. Everyone drives over the speed limit. And in that sense, we're all illegal drivers. But does that make someone bad? Because, no, you have to look at what the law is and what his reasons are. And someone who's coming to work and we've made it a crime to work, yes, you can call him, he's an illegal immigrant here. But I do not view that as a negative. Any more than I view someone who thinks these 55-mile-an-hour speed limits with modern roads and modern cars are ridiculous. I'm one of these people.
I use the example of prohibition. You know, there were all these illegal drinkers there. And when you appealed prohibition, you didn't still consider them illegal drinkers and go back and prosecute them. You appealed the stupid law, and now they became legal. So, yes, they were illegal immigrants, but – you know, if you change the law, then they become legal. And you know, so this whole issue of you have to send them back because they violated our laws. Well, if the laws are bad, then people are going to violate them. And you don't go back and penalize them for violating an irrational law, unless they're criminals. And if they're criminals, you treat them like criminals. You know, we have laws against theft and murder and things like that. You don't need ones for immigrants.
The Prohibition one's a good example. Ayn Rand said about that. I mean, she commended Americans for beginning to drink on principle when they passed Prohibition.
Yes. Yeah, so let's see. So what? Let's quickly deal with this issue of Muslims coming into the United States, and I don't know if we'll have time to talk about Europe, but I've talked about that on a separate show. So we clearly there is an Islamic threat to the United States. We refuse to identify what it is. We refuse to have a proper foreign policy. So as a consequence of that, we my guess is we're not even screening people who are coming in. For the likelihood that they could be a threat, what should be the proper approach to this issue of Muslims coming into the United States, given our foreign policy, which is nuts?
Yeah, I mean, I find it very difficult to say what.
Yeah, exactly.
Our foreign policy is so, I mean, incoherent is a mild description of what it is. That, I mean, what you said much earlier in the show about that it's not just you don't have a problem with profiling, that you should profile. I mean, I think that's an important point. The government should profile. It's looking for people who are part of terrorist networks, funding them, or who are state-sponsored, as from many of these countries. And that includes a country like Saudi Arabia, with you as an ally. And there should be... It's not this kind of blanket, indiscriminate, stupid kind of screening that happens when you go to the airports now. And, as you talked about previously, I mean, some 80-year-old lady who's obviously not any kind of threat, but we have to be not profile and so on. We have to do it random. And once you're profiling, you're looking, it's not ideological in the primary sense. It's membership in active support of these kinds of organizations that are dedicated to the destruction of American citizens, of the American government, and of the American nation. But it's our policy is so incoherent that, I mean, what can you tell government to do in this context?
I mean, it's so pathetic that when European or Americans are going and joining ISIS, which should be an act of treason, and these people should be arrested when they come home, they come back into Europe, they come back into the United States, and nobody, you know, those who are clearly enemies, there's no question about it. They should be stopped, they should be arrested. They're not even screened. So we have such a... incoherent policy, and yet, you know, when you're coming into the United States, you have a green card, you've got a job here, you know, everything, you're being harassed. But somebody who was just in Iraq fighting, they can't even keep track of them, and they can't even deal with them. It just drives me nuts. And for people to use this as an excuse to say, oh no, what we need is to stop all immigration because we can't keep track of these people. That's ridiculous. I mean, so we want to violate everybody's rights because the government is so pathetic in its ability to protect the little, you know, the few rights it tries to protect. It is pathetic in doing so. We should violate lots of people's rights as a consequence. I find just amazing.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I find it's interesting when you're talking about people who want to drastically reduce or eliminate immigration into the country, of how easily they switch from Muslims and terrorists to Hispanics. And you cannot put them in the same category. And it tells you, when that kind of switch happens, it tells you that something else is animating it, then I'm worried about terrorists.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I don't have any problem. I mean, to me, you've got to watch if you're Muslim, that should be profiled, it should be screened. You should, but I don't view an Hispanic. Again, I don't view my gardener. I don't view the people who do my laundry. I don't consider these enemies. I don't consider them threats. I don't consider them. And again, even if they blame for, even if they vote for people who are clearly rights violators, I blame Americans much more for that. I'm much more pissed off at the third generation American who's voting for to violate my rights than some immigrant that's coming in. And of course, a lot of these illegal immigrants, or all of the illegal immigrants, are not even voting, so they're not responsible for the violations of rights on me. So why hate them? Where does that yeah. come from? I want to touch on the issue, just on the issue of crime, which I think to the extent that there's a correlation between immigration and crime, it's because it's made illegal that drives crime, because it makes it, you know, it encourages certain types of people to come here who are more likely to commit crime. But I do find it interesting that over the last 30 years, where Republicans have claimed has been this massive Hispanic immigration into this country, has seen the sharpest decline in crime rates ever. And I'm not saying there's a causal relationship there, but it is an interesting phenomenon that crime today is far, far lower than it was in the 1970s and 80s. In all the major metropolitan areas, including the metropolitan areas which have large immigrant populations.
And again, from the economist / social scientist that I've seen, who I think actually know what they're doing with the statistics and the data, there's not any established correlation between crime and immigration.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and you know, it's probably the same as when, you know, the Italians were running the mafia and the Irish had their gangs in New York, and you know, there's an element that comes across that does that, but it's probably not any greater proportion than the domestic population, or at least I haven't seen any real studies as compared to some of the stuff that Ann Coulter does that really suggests that. Last point I want to make, which I think troubles me, and this is the idea of an objectivist community, an objectivist movement fighting for freedom, fighting for a movement towards more freedom, protection of individual rights, a proper role for government, and at the same time arguing against immigration, and how that, you know, that contradiction, I think. And given that we don't have much power to influence the debate anyway, right? In the short term, we are not going to change immigration policy in the United States. But that contradiction has to weaken our case when we're fighting for other freedoms.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually strongly think that, and this is an issue in which we could stress the positive, because there's that kind of view that what objectivists do is just harp on everything that's going wrong and so on. Immigration, and if you think just, because I do think of it in economic terms, it's an aspect of globalization. Indeed, economists talk about how there's more freedom of movement for capital now. There's more free trade than there was 30, 40 years ago. And if you think of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and so there's more movement and an increased globalization, which has had enormous positive impact on individual lives. And now the biggest controls are freedom of movement, and that if you could get more freedom of movement, you would see the dramatic increases in people's and individuals' productivity because of that. And I agree with that.
I think it's huge. I mean, I've seen some numbers, and our numbers are dangerous, but the impact would be enormous. And the other thing in terms of the positive is people always assume that immigration means that you're bringing in unskilled laborers. And my strong belief is that if you actually made immigration easier into this country, the best people in Europe, the best people in China, the best people in every country in the world would want to come here, and there I include the entrepreneurs, the people who want to, you know, 3/4 of all the PhDs and master's degrees in STEM, science, technology, and engineering are foreigners, and they would stay here and start companies and create enormous value because of the there's an advantage of doing that in the U.S. versus doing it in their home countries. And we would be flooded by millions of kind of immigrants.
From an individual perspective, it is, and it's again on the issue of the positive. I'm much more interested and concerned about the individuals in the world who are good, who want to make something of their lives, who have, through the complete misfortune, through no actions of their own, been born in some country that is a hellhole, and that they want to make something of their lives. That is an enormous positive, and it so outweighs if there's 10 or 50 people who want to come, like a ratio of 1 to 50, who want to come and they want welfare or they're going to want to join a terrorist network. And so it, one's orientation should be so much towards the positive and the impact and the value of those individuals. And if you look at it from your own life, if you were born in Ethiopia or Ecuador, you have one life to live, and you want to come to the U.S., and there's someone standing at the border saying, no, we don't allow entry to you. What is your view of that person, and what should it be, your view of that person? When there's objectivists that, we should close the borders and build walls and so on, it's such an anti-benevolent attitude, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I've often said that if I couldn't have come to the United States legally, I would have found a way to do it illegally. That is, it's what you have one life and you've got to make the most of it. And the people standing in your way are the enemy and they're the enemy of your life. And people need to individualize this rather than view this in collectivistic terms. It's collectivistic both in terms of the United States and in terms of the people trying to come in. Okay, we're out of time. Thanks, Ankar. I really appreciate this. I think this was an excellent discussion. We will continue talking about immigration in future shows. So if you have questions coming out of this discussion, send them in or call in or tweet me or Facebook me or whatever. I'll talk to all of you next week. The show is on live at 11:30. Every Saturday, look forward to talking to you next week. This is the Oran Brooks Show, signing off.